Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host and perpetual student of witchcraft and mysticism, Mikala Ann. This week, we welcome my new friend, writer, activist, filmmaker, and witch, Sarah Lyons, for a special in-person recording of the pod. I actually adored the background of city sounds you hear in this interview that I did with the City Mystic, discussing her two books, which I personally think were well missing from occult literature until she wrote them, How to Study Magic and Revolutionary Witchcraft. We giggle, we joke, we contemplate horror as we discuss some serious issues, such as who gets to define who as othered? Why is it so important to reclaim the term witch? How does the body act as an object held within the political dimension? What's the difference between calling yourself a witch versus magician? Why might we need the discipline of a container to unleash ecstasy? And perhaps most importantly, how can we find safety as we stand at crossroads, making deals with uncertainty? All this and more on today's episode of Saturn Vox. To find more on Saturn Vox, check out their Instagram and Twitter at Saturn Vox, or visit their website www.saturnvox.com. If you want to support the show towards goals of better equipment, merch, and bonus material, please check out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/saturnvox. where one can join in on our book club, in which we are currently reading the Magic and History compilation on Conjuring Spirits, compiled by Dr. Claire Fanger, and also join in on our Discord community, in which we are currently engaged in a deacon walk, complete with bouquet building and poetry forming.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. And in person, no less. This feels cool.
Yeah, I don't do this very often, so it's very casual and nice and cozy.
This is great. Yeah. So my name is Sarah Lyons. I am a witch, occultist, artist, filmmaker, writer, Leo Sun, Scorpio Moon, Sagittarius Rising. I've written two books on the subject of witchcraft and occultism. My first book, Revolutionary Witchcraft, came out in 2019. And my second book, How to Study Magic, came out just a couple months ago in 2022. And I am currently teaching a class by the same name of How to Study Magic through the Morbid Anatomy Museum, which might become a recurring thing. We'll have to see on that. And I am also a filmmaker in the process of making my first feature film. So that is a short introduction to me, but I'm sure we'll get into even more stuff in a second.
Yeah, wow, that is quite the repertoire. Yeah, we love having creatives on the pod. Okay, so let's start with the book that just recently came out, How to Study Magic.
Yes.
Do you think you can just explain, like, the impetus behind why you chose to write that book?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the most common question that people like us get asked is, like, how do you get into this stuff? Or, like, how do I do this stuff? The stuff is always the thing, like, well, what stuff do you want to get into? How do you want to do the stuff? Like, and I find that there's never really a satisfactory answer. It's kind of like when you ask artists, like, where do you get your ideas from? It's like, don't even, you know, like, everywhere. I think that there's, when people ask that, or when people are very, like, earnestly trying to get into magic or occultism, I find that a lot of people get really frustrated at that beginning part, because there's so much information and there's so many resources. There's literally, like, thousands, millions of years of stuff going on. And then it can be so highly individualized, and also there can be such like factionalism and like ways of looking at magic and ways of thinking about magic. If you're like in an order or a religion or a tradition of some sort, you're going to view it differently than other people. And we're in it, right? So we know how to navigate those waters. But I think that when a lot of people start out, they don't even know like what the waters are. So I wanted to write the book to kind of give new practitioners and people who don't even know what they don't know, like are kind of in the fool card part of their magical journey, like a vast overview of the different broad subjects that you're going to encounter when you first get into magic. So I go through like grimoire magic and witchcraft. I talk about paganism and chaos magic. And I talk about different like forms of magic that like ceremonial magic. And I try to give people a context for each of these. Like I try to put them into like historical context. I try to walk through like not just like red flags, but like, you know, this is something that you have to take very seriously. This one you can play around with a little bit more, etc. And then I give at the end of every chapter a piece from that tradition or from that school of magic to try out and like see how it feels, because I feel like it's you don't know what you want to get out of magic when you're first studying it, right? You just like are confronted by all of this, and I think the only way to really figure out what's right for you is if you try it out. So I did my best to kind of give people that compass, if you will, when they're going through the beginnings of their magical journey.
Wow, I love this. Yes, when our mutual friend Peter told me about this book, I was like, oh my gosh, we were so in need of something like this. In some ways, it was what I wanted my podcast to do initially. I was like, oh, if I invite people on from different traditions or from different things, then people can say, oh my God, there's like 500 different ways or currents that I can approach this through. But of course, it did end up getting narrowed into my own interests. So I love that you wrote this book. Do you find that you've been able to get some feedback from people now that it's been out for a while who have said like, oh wow, this really was the anchor I needed to help me navigate this space?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really good response so far. I think that the thing that I have liked is that I've gotten good feedback not only from practitioners, but also from like researchers and people who are interested in magic from maybe a more academic or like a less practical standpoint. So which is kind of what I wrote the book for. Like the way that I wrote it, you could read it front to back, or you can open it up and use it as a resource, right? If you are doing, if you're researching magic for some, you know, project or an art piece or a school paper, I don't, you know, whatever you're using it for, you can open it up and like check the book to kind of use it as an encyclopedia, but also use it as like a regular textbook. I think the response, like I think that the people that I have talked to who've read it from a practical standpoint have all been really appreciative of it. And I think it's, you know, there's so many introductory magic books out there. There's so many 101 books and courses and things like that. But again, it's, there isn't the 101 to the 101, at yeah. least for, in my opinion, or at least until I wrote it. People get in, they're like, okay, well, so do I do witchcraft? Like, am I a witch now? Like, do I read a bunch of Crowley stuff? Like, do I do astrology now? Like, you know, that people don't really know where even to start then. So even if you choose like a 101 witchcraft course, like maybe actually you wanted a ceremonial magic course. Maybe if you took a ceremonial magic course, maybe you actually wanted to get into like Islamic magic or Kabbalah, or, you know, there's so many different like things, and, you know, shamanism, whatever. And it's like, I think that there's, you don't really even know that this is available to you. And I think that just having that guide to the resources that are out there, it helps you not feel so overwhelmed and so, I mean, like, just kind of stupid. Like, I feel like when I try to put myself back into like the beginner mindset and the like where I was when I was a kid first getting into magic, and the world's changed so much since then. Like, I remember when I was, you know, like 13, 14, and I was first getting into, like, Wicca. Like, I thought that that was, like, the only game in town. Like, the only things that we had were, like, GeoCity sites and with, like, the little dragon counter at the bottom and, like, books that you could take out from the library that maybe weren't, like, you know, actual 101 Wicca books but were, like, you know, a world religion book that had, like, a tiny section on, like, witchcraft or something in it, right? And I think that we've come so far because now there's, like, all these, like, there's YouTube and there's TikTok and there's Instagram and there's blogs and there's all these different resources, but that almost creates more overwhelm because you, like, there's such a deluge of information, but the thing that the internet is really good at providing you with information, but it's also a context eating machine. And it, whether that is magic or whether that's anything else, like, what the internet does is just strip context from everything. And I think that the thing that really helps me and the thing that I've noticed has helped a lot of others is just providing even a little bit of context for where a practice comes from, how it's related to other practices, what, you know, where different ideas about magic come from. Even that little bit of context goes so far in helping people figure out what they want and avoid, like, pitfalls. Like, I think back to when I was first studying magic, and I wish I had had a book like this so that I didn't spend years trying to find, like, a patron goddess and god and, like, which is fine. Like, if that's what you want to do, that's totally fine. But it's not what I really wanted to do. Yeah. And I thought that was the only way to practice magic. And I think now maybe it was in the long run helpful because I've going down those pitfalls has helped me help other people. But that's why I wrote the book, is to help people on that part of their journey.
Ugh, yes. No, I vibe with that so hard. My own, like, personal experience of all of this when I was, like, 13, 14, and I'm, like, at Barnes & Noble's reading Sylvan Ravenwolf's How to Ride a Broomstick.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, I do, I like, reached a point where I was, like, I don't like this. This isn't how it wasn't serious enough for me or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I, like, go into academia. I'm, like, not doing magic. I'm studying philosophy. And it wasn't until I even graduated from my undergrad program that I kind of stumbled into grimoire traditions and, like, the astrological magic. And I was like, oh my God, there are other forms of this that are more in line with the kind of, like, sword behavior that I do in my head. And it did click. And it was suddenly like, oh, this is accessible to me again. So if I had Sarah Lyon's How to Study Magic at, you know, 13, 14, I would be a lot farther along on my journey because I wouldn't have taken all those years away saying, you know, Wicca's not for me. I'm not a Wiccan. I do think even today, like, when I tell people I'm a witch, they often divert to just thinking that I do some sort of neo-paganism, which is fine. That's actually probably to my best interest. But at the same time, it does feel very much like the world at large doesn't understand how in-depth or, like, how many paths and currents there really are for this work.
Yeah, it's interesting because I do a lot of, and I talk about this in the book, but I do a lot of interviews about this subject. And I've done, you know, interviews both, like, with, you know, people who practice magic, but then also a lot with, you know, TV and radio stuff where it's people who have absolutely no context or, like, or are not practitioners, like, at all. And I find sometimes when I talk about witchcraft, I'm not trying to undo myths or to explain things about my practice so much as I'm trying to, like, almost de-Wiccanize people's idea of what witchcraft is. And again, I think it's easy to kind of, like, shit talk Wicca because, like, I think in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was kind of the, like, Silver Ravenwolfification, like, Crushed Velvet Robification. And, like, I want to be very clear, like, I think if that is, like, your religion and if that is, like, your practice, like, I say go for it. Like, I really think, like, whatever floats your boat. And I think that, you know, I say this in the book too, is, like, you know, Wiccans did fight, like, civil rights battles that, like, opened up a lot of this stuff that we you know, take place, you know, take part in now. So I don't want to discount, like, the Margot Adlers and the, like, the, you know, the different, like, you know, leaders in the past who, like, actually did do a lot to, you know, I don't, like, I'm trying not to use, like, words that sound so cheesy, but, like, it's true, like, raise awareness and, like, bring this stuff into a, like, greater context and, like, the wider, like, cultural sphere and, like, political sphere. Like, I don't want to discount that, right? Having said all of that, I do also think that there is, in doing that, Wicca also sort of made itself, at least culturally, you know, the narrative was, like, witchcraft isn't about the devil and it's not about this. It's really about the goddess and it's about the burning times and all of that. And I, you know, again, if you, I kind of in the book talk about how I think there's maybe four different strains of witchcraft, like dominant strains of witchcraft. And if the neo-pagan one is like yours, that's great. But also there is a huge connection between, like, historically between witchcraft and the devil, and there is a huge connection between witchcraft and, like, the darkness and shadow and the crossroads and, like, weirdness. I think that witchcraft is, by definition, something that can't be defined, you know? Like, I think it's one of the most slippery forms of magic most difficult to define forms of magic. And so when I do interviews about it, it's not so much even explaining what I do, it's explaining what I don't do and opening up a new understanding of that because of that, like, dominant kind of cultural paradigm. And I do think it's changing a little bit, but it is, it's interesting though.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct when you say the way that Wiccans asserted a palatability to what they were doing is the reason why I can publicly announce I'm a witch.
Yes.
And not get burned at the stake, basically.
Yeah.
Even if I'm not participating in the same current that they are, I benefit from what they brought politically to the table. And that is, you know, that is still like ancestors of the witch blood to me. That's still something that I need to give reverence to and honor, even if, you know, goddess worship is not necessarily my path.
Mm-hmm.
I love that you brought up the political aspect. I think if I were to have to define witchcraft, a lot of the times I talk about it in terms of, like, witchcraft is a religion or a practice for those who have been othered and who have been oppressed. And I actually have talked a lot, at least on, like, the internet, maybe not on the podcast, about that I believe witchcraft is inherently political.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that you also wrote Revolutionary Witchcraft. I actually did read that book in 2020, during all the protest times. So maybe we can, like, transition a bit into what the inspiration for writing Revolutionary Witchcraft was.
Sure. So I was actually approached by the publisher about that one. They had read some of my other writing previously, and they wanted a book about, you know, politics and witchcraft. And I had already been working on an outline for a book like that for a little while. And so when they approached me and said, like, hey, would you be willing to write this book? I was like, yes, I can. And I had, like, a proposal, like, ready to go, which is great. So I wrote that book because, again, I think similar to How to Study Magic, I wanted to give, first of all, like, sort of a compass to people who are getting into either magic or politics. The idea behind that was, if you are practicing magic and this is maybe your first book on activism or politics, then this is a good introduction for you. But if you have already been doing activism or political work in some way, but you haven't really thought about a magical dimension to that, it's a good introduction to the magical side of that. So I wrote it to be sort of a crossroads, if you will, like sort of a bridge between those two worlds. And the turnaround on that was actually 3 months. So I had to really just, like, sit down and put myself into the chamber of revolutionary witchcraft, where, like, there was a solid 3 months where, like, all I did was watch political documentaries and, like, listen to, like, Rage Against the Machine and, like, write that book. And it was really intense. And now that I've written a second book, I'm like, how the fuck did I write that first one? But that was kind of the inspiration for it. And then it turned out it was, in some ways, it sucked that it came out at the time that it did, because I had a whole bunch of classes and book tours and stuff queued up for 2020. But at the same time, I think it kind of came out perfectly, because I had a lot of people reach out to me, like, during the uprising in 2020, like, during the last couple of years, and say how much the book helped them during that time. And that's, like, the best compliment you can get as an author, personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it came out at the perfect time.
Yeah.
When I read it, I didn't even realize how new it was. It was just like, oh, of course now is the time to read about revolutionary witchcraft.
Here's the time. Yeah, here yeah. we go.
So are you also in that camp of, like, holding space that witchcraft is implicitly political, whether or not you're doing activism with it?
What I often go back to and talk to people about is that I think the term witch, especially as we understand it historically, is a political term because it's a legal term oftentimes, right? Like, who gets to define who is a witch and who is not? Who gets to define themselves as a witch or not? Who gets to be called a witch, and who gets to call someone a witch? What are the consequences of calling yourself or calling someone else a witch? These are all political questions, right? Because if we're talking about politics, we're talking about the ways in which power moves and manifests through society, and what things uphold or separate a society, right? And I think that, like, we can sit here and we can talk about being witches because we have a certain political power that other people in other parts of the world don't have. And if they called themselves that, they might be killed. Or if they were to be called that, they would be killed. I think that there's, when you go back and look at the history of witchcraft, of course, like, it's difficult to find, like, the witches, because people didn't self-identify that way until very recently in, broadly speaking, the West. capital T, capital W. But I think who gets called a witch is always politically motivated in the past, because it is a legal term that is thrown at people that society, the state, capital wants to get rid of in some way. Or even if a community turns on itself or wants to other people within the community, that's the word that gets, like, brought up and used, right? I think that we see that right up until the present day. This is part of my thing of, like, you don't have to go back and... We spent so much time wondering, like, why did the witch trials happen? Like, why did these, you know, these things happen? Like, how come Europe just, like, shit the bed for a couple hundred years, right? And, you know, I think the people want a simple answer to that question, because if it's one thing that happened, if it's, like, ergot poisoning, or if it's, a revolt against the final vestiges of paganism, then it's safe, right? It saves us, because if it's just that one thing, well, then let's just not do that one thing ever again, right? Let's just get rid of that one part. And obviously it's complicated, because people are complicated. We have the same brains that they had in the early modern period, right? And so I think that you don't have to even go back that far. Like, it is interesting and it is good to look back at, like, the history of the witch trials, the history of people who have been called witches, and to see the political nature in that. But even in recent history, in modern history, you see it. I used this metaphor during my How to Study Magic class recently, but if you look at something like the Indonesian genocide in the 1950s, there was something that was kind of perfected at that time called the Jakarta Method. And I'm getting a lot of this from this book called The Jakarta Method by Vincent Bevins, which I highly recommend checking out that book. But one of the things he talks about in the book is that, in the 1950s, post-World War II, Indonesia had the largest political party in the world, which was the Communist Party of Indonesia. And it was an unarmed political party. It was winning elections democratically, and it was doing so in conjunction with a very popular women's movement in the country that was, like, pushing for marriage equality, pushing for, fair pay, pushing for abortion rights, pushing for gay rights, all of these things, right? And that was not very popular with the CIA. And one of the things that they did, as you can imagine, one of the things that they did is they began to fund, you know, right-wing death squads within the country. And what those squads did is they used the folklore and mythology of parts of Indonesia to begin to sow these seeds against these female, like, organizers on the other side. And what they would do is they would say, those women are witches. And they're going to come out from the forest and they're going to mutilate you. They're going to cut off your dick and they're going to kill you and they're going to, like, burn your village to the ground, right? And, of course, that wasn't true. But using, even right there, using, like, witches as a thing to create this fear, to create this animosity, made these death squads go ahead and do that exact same thing in response, right? And, I mean, if you've ever seen the movie The Act of Killing, like, that is what this time period is about. It's extremely brutal. It's extremely horrific. And the effects of it are still being felt today, not only in Indonesia, but all over the world. In the coming decades, when there would be a coup or, a, you know, a death squad coming in places like South America, it actually became very common for right-wing groups to graffiti on walls, "Jakarta is coming." And it just became this calling card of how to go about destabilizing left-wing movements all over the world, movements for workers' rights, women's rights, you know, queer rights, etc. And I think that, you know, we can, I think it's incredibly important to look back to the early modern period. It's incredibly important to look back to the old history and the ancient history of witchcraft. But you don't even have to do that to make those parallels. Like, we have that story right there that shows us just how politically charged a word witchcraft is, and how witch has been used right here and now by, like, living people as a tool of oppression.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, like, when you're actually practicing witchcraft, what you come to realize is that magic is implicitly about gaining agency. Mm-hmm. So, of course, that's horrifying to the powers that be that, you know, maintain their power by making us feel small. But it's interesting to see how that carries over into people who are not practicing witchcraft. Anybody who is gaining self-agency, whether it's through women's charm, like Anne Boleyn, or whether it's through, you know, political affirmation of our rights, like you're talking about in the Jakarta movement. Anyone who is starting to say, I have agency of my own, gets labeled a witch, whether they are practicing witchcraft or not. And that's a very interesting crossover I'd not noticed before until you started talking. So
yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's part of the that's part of the appeal of actually using the word witch, is that reclamation and seeing it as, like, yes, it is a word used to demonize people, and I want to reclaim that, because the things that want us demonized are things I'm in opposition to. Like, they are my enemies, and I am, like, going to take this word that they would use against me, and I'm going to wear it as a badge of honor, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that that is a big part of the political dimension of witchcraft to me. Obviously, there is also, like, the practical part, and there is the, you know, I think that witchcraft too, like I was saying, it's so hard to define, because I think that so much of witchcraft is about, and I know you've talked about this here before, but it is, like, about the body and the, not just the physical body, but the spiritual body, the many souls, the extended soul. I think that there is I think that it's what makes witchcraft hard, even within the occult community, to define or to reckon with, because, like, so much of occultism is, like, the nerd's nerd stuff, you know? It's like, Do you like reading books for fun? Well, I have the spiritual path for you. Like, wow. All we're doing is reading, baby. Like, come
call
on.
Call out.
Yeah, no. I mean, you have great books here.
Thank
but,
you.
You know, it's real. It's like it's like, hey, did you love mythology when you were a kid? Guess what? You get to be a part of it now. Like, it's such a, you know, I think that witchcraft kind of comes along and it is about study and it is about books. I have written two books. I am not discounting study. One of them has the word study in it. I am not discounting study. But there is this, like, experiential embodied part of it. And I think that that is where witchcraft is often so aligned with, like, queerness, with femininity, with, like, women, with trans people. Like, I think that that's one reason why it's so aligned with that, because these are groups of people who have so much to say about the body and are, like, so aware of bodies, whether because of, you know, felt, like, lived experience, or because, like, you're being forced to reckon with that because of the political dimension that you're living in. Like, you're forced to reckon with your body as a political dimension. The thing about witchcraft is that it encompasses both of these worlds. And I think that that's sometimes difficult for people to wrap their heads around, as opposed to other magical practices where it's like you have these holidays every year, you do these, like, rituals every day, there is, like, these gods that you believe in or don't believe in, and, like, this is the underlying, like, ethic, or you know, like, this is the underlying, like, paradigm that you subscribe to. And witchcraft comes along and is like, it's all real. Like, it's all yes and.
I love that. So when you wrote How to Study Magic, was that a part of, like, what you touch on, that there does seem to be even both a political and an embodied difference between people who choose to identify as a witch versus people who are like, I am a magician?
I think that it tends to be that way. I mean, obviously there's, like, huge overlap. And again, this is, like, kind of similar to Wicca. This is not me dissing on anybody who practices, like, ceremonial magic. Like, I practice ceremonial magic. Like, I think there's a lot of benefit to that as a practice. And that's why I identify as both an occultist and a witch, because I do see a lot of my spirituality coming from the kind of broader Western, like, mystical, Western esoteric tradition. And to me, that is kind of, like, occultism. But then witchcraft comes along and there is this, like, intersection with the Western esoteric tradition, but it also kind of goes in its own direction of, like, plant matter, of embodiment, like we're talking about, of the kind of more than human making aspect of it, less than human aspect, like, like that whole, that conversation. I think, yeah, I one of the reasons that I put in that book practices for people to do at the end of every chapter is I think that you have to kind of feel how these things interact with you in your body and in your mind, right? Because if you are someone who really is not good with, like, books, if you're someone who's really not good with, let me think of an example for this. Like, I really am bad at math. Like, I am, like, so terrible with numbers. I can't keep them in my brain. They all look the same to me. I am not someone who loves numerology or, like, parts of, like, Kabbalah or parts of, like, Jewish mysticism that contain a lot of, like, numerology as a core thing, because numbers are, like, not for me. So if we lived in a world where that was, like, that was the Wicca, like, that was the biggest form of magic available to people, I'd be like, I don't want to practice magic. Like, this is just math. Like, you know, in even astrology, I get to a point, like, as soon as we get to, like, decans and degrees, I'm like, I'm out. Like, this is, like, I'll hire a professional at that point, you know? Yeah. Because it's like, that is just so, like, I make this joke all the time, but I'm like, I got into magic because I'm bad at math. But like, I don't want to do more math, you know? But, like, maybe that's if you are a math nerd, and you are, like, you are someone who's, like, sees math as, like, you know, the handwriting of God or something, to quote Pacific Rim. But if you see, I didn't realize I did that until I did that. But if you see that as, like, a really sacred thing to you, then, like, maybe numerology or certain parts of, like, Jewish or Islamic or Christian mysticism is, like, for you, because there's so much numerology and math and numbers in it, right? That's kind of why I think you gotta just get in there and try out these things, because if you only read about this, if you only study, then you're not gonna know how it actually affects your life or your brain or your heart. And I think it's important that people get in there and see if they want a more embodied practice, or if they want a more, like, by the book kind of, like, heady practice, if they want something really formalized and serious, or if they need, you know, if they're a creature of structure and habit, or if they're a creature of, like, spontaneity, and what parts of their life maybe need that more. Like, I'm someone who really, like, I like my rituals because I like my routines, you know, and I have my daily things that I do every day, and I like that because I'm a creature of habit and routine. But I wouldn't have known that unless I started doing it, you know? Yeah. So.
Oh, I love that answer. I used to tell people, start with whatever tradition your ancestors might have practiced, but, you know, that was infantile of my own self. Because I realized over time that actually, you know, my ancestors' magic maybe wasn't for me. Mm. And it did, I mean, you are correct that it took me doing it to realize this is maybe not for me. But this is another reason why I'm really excited about your book. Because now instead of telling people, I don't know, just do like Catholic folk magic and see if you like it, I can say, read Sarah Lyon's book and see what you like from there.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I really wrote the book for people in our, like, I wrote it for people who are new, but I also kind of wrote it for people in our community so that when you get that question, you can be like, just read this book.
Yes.
Like, I don't have time for that to answer this question, just read this book.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, because it's hard. Like, it's a hard question, and how do you answer? Everyone's journey to this stuff is so individual. Like, do you just tell someone to go drop acid and live in the forest for 10 years? Like, do you tell someone, like, oh, yeah, go take a university course on all of these different things? Like, oh, well, you gotta, like, get initiated to this and that. Like, everyone's so different that, you know, it's what worked for you might not work for the person who's asking you that question. And you know that, but it's hard to even describe that mm-hmm. to someone. So that's partially why I try to write the book in a very, like, conversational manner so that it feels like you've got me in the room with you going, like, yes, this is good. No, that's not so great, you know? Or, like, yeah, you're doing fine. Try this, you know? Yeah.
Oh, I love that. So, just going back to, like, what you were saying about all the math and stuff, that was making me think about John Dee mm-hmm. and, like, John Dee receiving from the angels this very mathematic and, like, codified system of magic. And something that has always kind of struck me about that was, well, John Dee was a cryptographer. Like, mm. he was a master codesmith. That was what he did. He was a spy and he, you know, was a mathematic genius. So it made sense to me then that when he's communicating with these spirits, the way that they're talking to him is in a way that he himself would understand. And in that way, I feel like maybe Enochian magic is very specific to people whose brain functions that way, but it may not be the only way to communicate with angels.
Yeah. Yeah, I find it's so, angels are such an interesting topic, right? Because I think that there's kind of like witchcraft, there's like the kind of popular imagining of them. There's what we in, like, the, like, in the magic world kind of think of them. And then there's, like, this kind of third option, right? Like, I almost go full circle with them sometimes, right? I had this kind of realization when I was, like, studying Enochian, like, a little while ago. And this is just kind of my own, like, personal gnosis or whatever. So people might disagree with this. But I think that part of the reason why Enochian magic can really fuck up your life sometimes and, like, isn't for everyone is because I like, if you think about angels, it's like they're programmed to see everything as God. Like, they don't have that separation that we have when they're looking at creation. And so when we experience something bad or disappointing, we have that, like, ego that we've been given, right? That's like, oh, this is disappointing, this is sad, I'm, like, hung up about this in some way, or, like, oh, this was really horrible, I don't want to do this anymore, whatever. And angels are like, but it's God. It's, but God, everything's God, it's cool, you know? And we're like, yeah, but no, but this hurts me, you know? And they're like, what's hurt? Hurts God too, you know? Yes. And I think that there's also that, I think is, I think that can be a thing that is difficult to work with angels for, because the thing that makes them so incredible, the thing that makes them so great, is also the thing that literally differentiates them from us, and is, like, you know, why I think a lot of people, maybe if they do get into magic, maybe they get into, like, Luciferian side of it, because at least that's a figure that we can, like, understand. Like, that's a figure that, like, there's a humanness there. There's mm-hmm. a separation from the divine there, or a rebellion there that we understand, but the angels are so not human that it's hard in a way that even, like, the gods are not, like, yeah. You can even understand the motivation of certain gods sometimes more than angels, right? And then there are, like, little old ladies that talk to angels and they do incredible stuff. And it's like, and it's like, well, maybe that is an angel. Maybe that's something else. I don't know. But I just have to, like, trust you, because that's incredible that you just did that, you know? Yeah.
Oh, love that answer. Yeah, with the devil stuff, I mean, it's like, well, they are enfleshed mm-hmm. and embodied. And in that way, like, they, even if, you know, some mythologies of the devil do hold that the devil is already redeemed, so I don't want to harp too much on the rebellion mm-hmm. aspect of it, but there is, like, an understanding of fleshed pain mm-hmm. and, like, fleshed longing.
Oh, yeah.
That devils tend to sympathize with the human, whereas you're right, the angels are more like, I don't care, like, just, this is, I fulfilled your request. Maybe your life blew up, but I did what you wanted me to do.
It's your fault for having that ego of yours.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
What's that about? Yeah, and it's weird. In the book, I kind of tell people, like, look, I'm not, like, I'm a fuck around and find out kind of person when it comes to magic. I think Enochian stuff, especially for beginners, can be really tricky. And what I kind of told people in the book is, like, don't feel pressured to start this off. Like, this is actually probably better for you to get into once you get into other stuff first. Like, get yourself a basic, like, meditation and cleansing practice, and then we'll circle back to John Dee and yes. and that system of magic later, you know? Because, and it's weird that is the one that I tell people to kind of, like, wait on, when I don't tell them to necessarily even wait on, like, Goetia or something like that. I think that it surprises people, because we're so used to seeing angels as this, like, holy, benevolent, positive force. And, like, maybe in a cosmic way they are, but certainly not to our puny minds.
Yeah, well, I think you make a really valid point. This is something that Sasha and I were talking about in the last episode, is, like, if God is all things, then God is also the monster. Then mm-hmm. God is also the horror. God is also the fear. And I think it's interesting that you, as a filmmaker, are working on horror mm-hmm. and self-identify as a witch. So do you, I mean, even if you do feel more like, let's be careful with angel magic, you do seem to have an acknowledgement of horror and the monster as being a part of the divine.
Yeah, I mean, I think the film that I'm working on right now is a story that's been in my head for a very long time. And I don't want to go too deep into, like, the plot and everything, but it deals with that kind of the horror of surrender is almost what I keep going back to. Ah, but it's like the watching someone let go, and you can't stop them from letting go.
Yeah.
And there's maybe a seduction there. There's maybe there's a horror there that you want to stop this person from just letting go and surrendering to this awe-inspiring, and, like, the horror of awe that surrounds us and is inescapable, even once we escape it. I'm being so vague about this movie right now.
No, but that literally gave me chills. I love that. There's this idea that, like, God is, you know, that we should approach God with awe. And I find that people often forget awe is the word that is contained within both awesome and awful. Mm-hmm. And in that way, God is both awful and awesome at the same time. And that is horrifying.
Yes. And I think there's something, it's, I think for myself, it's something that I struggle with a lot. Like, I think that I'm someone who, even as much as I believe, this is maybe, like, I think my whole spiritual journey sometimes is just, like, one really long process of getting me to lighten up. Like, I mean, like, and I say this as someone who's, like, has a good sense of humor, but I think of myself as too serious, and I think of myself as really scared of letting go and giving up control and, like, letting that spirit sort of take me sometimes. And so maybe there's a reason behind that that's valid, and maybe some of it is just pure fear, but I think that there's something I envy sometimes when I see people who can just, like, let go and just trance out in public, can just, you know, completely let themselves, even if it's a mess, like, even people who, like, their lives are a mess, sometimes I envy that, because I'm like, wow, I don't know what, it's so hard for me to get to that place of just, like, surrender, you know? But there's also, like, a horror, because you don't know where that surrender leads.
Yes.
And where, if someone falls, where they fall to. And so I think in making this movie, it's called The Woods, and it's set in woods, and it is kind of using the woods as a metaphor for that, like, all-encompassing, chaotic, yet intelligent force that kind of surrounds us in, like, the world that we find ourselves in. Like, I see in, this is, I mean, like, maybe spoiling some of the themes, but it's like, I don't just see the woods as the physical woods that the characters find themselves in. I find it the world that they live in total. And this is just an experience that brings that to the forefront.
I love that. From one Saturn person to another,
hey.
I totally understand the fear of letting go of control. I think that's, like, a big one with Saturn people, because we're like, everything needs to be within the container and disciplined and da-da-da. And yeah, when I have that same reaction when I see people who I view as just, like, able to be free, freely themselves, even if it is messy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird, because when I was doing a lot of my Saturn readings for people as Saturn was ingressing into Pisces, that seemed to, like, be a big theme in the readings, was, like, you can actually let go. Things are actually okay. You don't need to, like, hold on so tightly. So it's interesting that, like, Saturn in Pisces theme does seem to be the horror of surrender, the suffering of surrender, and, like, how that does shake us to our core. Because if you are a person who's comfortable with routine and things have been routinely shitty, then you start to get uncomfortable when it shifts into being a more liberatory experience.
Yeah, and I think that there's, you know, this is kind of maybe this is a good, like, bow to tie all of this up in, right? That there's benefits to both of these tendencies in magic, right? There's a benefit and drawback, right? There's, like, the kind of ceremonial magic, like, rigor and study and, like, consistency, discipline, like, books, words, like, like, spells, these things that go back so long and stood the test of time, and, like, that itself being a part of it, right? There's that piece that I think is so beneficial, and that I think that, you know, you need, like, if, like, the lattice work to let the tendrils grow up, but also the tendrils are gonna go where they want to go, you know. And there's this other side of magic that is this ecstatic, chaotic, wild thing that is never truly to be understood definitionally, right? Like, is literally beyond what we are capable of understanding through the mind. And I think that, like, that's why I can't get down with completely one or the other. And I try to see my practice as being almost a combination of those two things, because while I think that it's one, these things will come easier to one person or another, like the ecstatic witchcraft or fully embodied practice might come easier to some people. Ritual and learning might come easier to others. There's people like myself who kind of like walk in between fairly okay, but it is I think that that's a big just like dance in magic, and I guess I don't see one as being better than the other, but both will always exist and both are necessary for like life itself. Mm-hmm. You know, and this web that we're all weaving together, and I think that sometimes in magic, we want to say like, well, this is it, this isn't. But I really feel like we're all sitting at the weirdos table, and we're all like, there's a real, I'm trying to think of the right way to say this, but I think we all help each other when we do our magic right. And when we do it like with our hearts, like we all benefit in this like sort of web that we're weaving together.
Yes. Oh, I totally agree. I think, you know, well, first of all, it's like you kind of need the discipline and the container as your tools to even go into the woods safely.
Yes.
And dance ecstatically, to have the more rigorous, disciplined tools gives you the permissions to let loose and surrender. So I like that. But also, there's so much wisdom in what you're saying about us all co-creating together. And that's kind of like this thing of we're all kings in a shared kingdom. Everybody has a different reflection of the all being's power and light within us. And we're not meant to fulfill every role.
Yeah. I mean, you even said something very interesting before we sat down, where you said, I need to give myself permission to be feral. And isn't that a weird contradiction in terms, right? Like, isn't that exactly like the heart of this, right? Of like permission to be feral. Like, it's like, does like, like feralness that's like, hey, I'm about to wild out, but like, is everyone cool first? If I like, you know, yes. Yeah.
The safety necessary to surrender.
Yeah. Yeah. And that container. And I think that that is, I think when you're able to thread that needle, that's when real, like, magic happens, you know, at least in my experience, at least in my practice, you know?
No, I completely agree. I feel like, you know, a part of what it has meant for me to be a Saturn person has been understanding the consequences of certain things and then taking a step back in order to give myself safety. And that was actually a refusal to allow my light to shine because I was afraid of such and such consequence. But now that I have like cultivated a deeper discipline, cultivated tools that are more healthy, I can now return to childlike wonder in a way that is safe, in a way that like I can create without the fear of such and such a consequence, because I now know how to navigate the dance.
Absolutely. I feel that 100%.
It's good. It's freeing. Yeah. It's like this weird contradiction between liberation only being possible, as we've been saying, within a container, and this like beautiful push and pull between like Saturn and Jupiter, you know?
I think also, like, I guess to bring it back to the book, there's this thing that I ask people like throughout the book of like, what do you want to get out of magic, right? Because if you want practical results, like if you need money and you need a job, like you are going to be doing maybe very different things than if you desire like a connection to divinity. Like just, and it's just a pure, like you want a communion with the world. And obviously these things can go together, right? Like having a relationship with a deity, a spirit, the divine, like, etc. Obviously, that can lead to practical benefits in your life. Obviously, you can either ask that spirit for things down the line, or just, you know, by virtue of this practice, things maybe get better in your life, or some of the doors open, whatever. There's obviously that dimension to it. But I think that where you start from is going to be very different depending on what your immediate needs are or what your wants are. And I think that that's a question that we almost stop asking ourselves once we've been in this so long. But it's important, I think, to go back every now and then and be like, okay, what am I, like, what role is spirituality playing in my life, right? Like, am I doing this because I feel guilty? Am I doing this because I want something? Am I doing this because this makes me feel good? Like, and I think that it's really worth all of our time, no matter if you're starting off doing magic or if this is something you've been doing for a very long time, like, go back and check in on that every now and then and be like, is this still working? Is this just a force of habit? Have I changed since I started doing this? Have things gotten better or worse? Am I, like, what is the goal of me pursuing this particular practice over this one, you know? And I think that that can be such a clarifying question to what discipline of magic you want to study. Yeah. And what path you want to take.
No, that is, ooh, that is very wise. I definitely know that I started with what I wanted, and it was great, and it's still great, and I still continue a very strong theurgic practice. But if you only do theurgy, you're going to find that, like, oh, I'm only losing jobs instead of getting them, because the spirits keep being like, this isn't your will. This isn't your will. Let me help. Let me help. And I'm like, no, I am a human and I need money now. And so I had to, like, incorporate more practical magic into the work that I was doing. I had to learn new skills in order to kind of bring my human needs versus just my spiritual wants into the practice.
That's very real, yeah.
A roller coaster of emotions can occur there, but just to, like, know, oh, I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not fucking up. I'm actually doing the magic too well, and now I need to switch into a different current to, like, make something else happen.
That is extremely real.
All right, well, I guess we're getting towards the end of our time together.
This has been such a great interview.
Thank you.
This is so lovely.
I have enjoyed spending the weekend with you. It has been very fun getting to know you and exploring our interests of weirdness together.
Same to you. This has been lovely.
Thank you. I do like to end the interview on the same question. Basically, I just am giving you permissions to say whatever you feel like has been left unsaid. If there's anything that you would be remiss to leave this interview having said or not said, like, now is your moment to share whatever.
Oh, man. What can I say? I guess the first thing that's, like, speaking to the that pops into my head right now, the thing that's, like, popping into my head right now is, like, just, like, since I wrote Revolutionary Witchcraft, and now, just, like, how much seems to have changed, how much shifting has gone on. I feel like in a lot of things, like in magic, in politics, in culture, in life, there's this feeling that we all have right now of, like, almost like holding our breath. Like, what's coming? And there's this tension in the air right now, but we don't know if that's just because things are tense and we're just going to remain tense, or if something's about to happen, or if something's not going to happen. Like, there's this huge feeling right now that I get of feeling like we're at a crossroads, and feeling like we're in the dark about where those crossroads are leading us. And I get the sense of just, like, I want to speak to that, because I think that, like, every time I talk to people about that, it's like, oh my God, I thought I was the only person feeling that way. So I think it's just good to acknowledge, like, in the world right now, things are very weird. But we practice magic because we want to get comfortable in those weird spaces and, like, see the sacredness in them. And I think, again, if there is, like, a benefit that maybe witchcraft as a practice has, it is living at that crossroads and knowing how to make a deal with that tension, you know, and that uncertainty. And I think that might just be where we find ourselves as a whole right now. And it might be good, even if you're not a witch or even if witchcraft isn't your practice right now, to feel into that a little bit and see what comes of that when you allow yourself to sit in that ambiguity for just a little bit. We're all going through it right now, and I think it's just important to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Do you have, like, any kind of meditative practice that you yourself do to sit with that you might want to offer the listeners?
I mean, my daily practice is that I try to meditate once a day, and I do the LBRP once a day. And then, and I have, like, other, like, I have my spirits and that I leave, like, water to and offerings to. And those are the kind of daily things that I do. But then it's like, that's, like we said, like, that's the container. And then once I'm in that container, it's about what is needed and felt on a day-to-day level. And I think in terms of something to get through it, I don't know. I think that something that has helped me recently, and I won't give a specific one to people because I think this is very individual, but I think finding a prayer or a phrase that resonates with you and repeating it as many times as possible until it literally just becomes, like, nonsense in your head, and then pushing through that and getting past that till it's not nonsense, it's everything sense. You know, it makes sense of everything all of a sudden, and then it goes back to being a phrase again. And, like, just seeing how a simple prayer or a phrase can grow and swell like that, and how when you have it memorized, you hold on to it like a rope or a string tied to a balloon. I think that that's been really helpful to me lately, and I think I would offer that to people.
Oh, I love that.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Michaela.
This has been wonderful.